Welcome to Tardi Mecha Nachyomi. My name is Adina Schmidman. I invite you to join the OU Women's Initiative Monday, November 28th at 12 noon Eastern Time for the Siyum for Sefer Yecheska with Mrs. Rena Foreman. Go to ou.org/women/siyum to sign up for reminders and the Zoom link. And now for today's perek.
Welcome to Tardi Mecha Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Rena Foreman, and today we will be studying Yecheskel, Perek Memhei, Chapter 45. We ended off the last perek with a question. Clearly, the Kohanim in the third Mikdash have two basic jobs, Avodah and Shmirah, working and guarding. We asked, why are these particular roles so crucial? And we also pointed out that the coupling of these two roles brings us back to Hashem's original special place on earth, Gan Eden itself. Man's original role in the garden was La'avda u'lishomra, to work and guard it, the same two things the Kohanim are charged with doing in the Mikdash. Back in the garden, though, man's ability to fulfill these two tasks was short-lived. We ate from the tree of knowledge, and we were expelled from the garden. And when that happened, humans couldn't fulfill that role anymore. Man was now sent off to be obeyed elsewhere, to work other land. In the words of the text back in Bereishit, "Vayishalchehu Hashem Elokim migan Eden la'avod et ha'adama asher lukach misham," God sent him from Gan Eden to work the land from which he was sent. As for Shmirah of the garden, God set up other beings, angels, to at least watch over God's special place in mankind's absence. Vayashkein bikedem legan Eden et hakruvim, lishmor et darach etz hachayim. God set up kruvim, angels, to the east of Gan Eden to guard the tree of life. And that's the way it was for a long time. But then, later in history, when the Beit HaMikdash was first built, there would be a new special place on earth for Hashem, a place for his kavod. So now, there would be a changing of the guard. In that new place, there would be humans, Kohanim, who would take over for the Kruvim. Man was back. He could be obeyed, work in God's house, and it would be up to him to be Shomer, to guard it too. There would be a memory of the Kruvim in the Mikdash. That would take the form of cherub statues atop the Aron in the Kodesh HaKodashim, God's holiest place on earth. But Kruvim, they were only statues. The work Kruvim used to perform would now be performed by humans. Up until they couldn't anymore. When the people sinned, there was another expulsion. An exile from Hashem's special place, from Israel and the Mikdash. And with that, God's presence would depart into a mobile home, a Merkava in the heavens, the Merkava Yecheskel witnessed in chapter 1. So, once again, as it happened before in Gan Eden, when man was expelled, the Kruvim, they needed to go live again, if you will. Now, Kruvim had a job to do. They needed to actually serve as guardians of God's now mobile home, the Merkava. In Yecheskel, in Perek Yud, Yecheskel has a vision as to how Yerushalayim was destroyed and how that Merkava developed. And if you look at the Psukim there, you might get a little confused. It seems a bit fuzzy, the Kruvim there. Were they statues or live angelic beings? Early in the Perek, the Kruvim seemed to start out as statues in the actual Mikdash that's about to be destroyed. But then Yecheskel sees an awesome sight. He witnesses the Kruvim coming to life and rising and flying away from the Mikdash, which is why he exclaims at the sight of these live Kruvim, "Hi hachaya asher ra'iti tachat Elokei Yisrael b'nei har kfar." These Kruvim, these are the live beings I saw in God's presence at the Merkava vision in Nahar Kvar. he finally understands the meaning of the Merkava, and he names the Kruvim Chayot, live beings. It is as if the statues in the Merkava have come to life. And that's the way it would stay when man was in exile. Kruvim would guard God's presence in the heavenly Merkava. But now, at the end of Sefer Yechezkel, once the third bayit is erected, the Kruvim, they're back. But they take the form of statues again. This time, they are relegated to the wood panels of Hashem's home. Represented on those panels, those Kruvim are guardian of trees, of all things. For now that God is permanently home, the workers and keepers of God's special place will be humans once again. These will be the Kohanim, whose job will be to teach the difference between Kodesh and Chol, and to help the people keep them separate, Lahavdil, Bein Kodesh L'Chol, so that both God and the people will be able to live together successfully. The vision of Yechezkel in Perek Mem Daled, it maps out many new laws for the Kohanim, these new guardians of God's Kavod. All told, these laws seem to impose a higher degree of Kedusha upon the Kohanim than in the first Mikdash. Things like not marrying an almana, a widow, for example, similar almost to a Kohen Gadol, or clothes that are more similar to those of a Kohen Gadol. Maybe in this third Mikdash, it's important to err somehow on the side of greater Kedusha. These Kohanim need to be Kadosh, separate, and teach the nation how to maintain high standards of Kedusha themselves. And in concert with that idea, at the end of Perek Mem Daled, in Pasuk Chav Chet, we learn that these Kohanim will be able to maintain a separate existence. They will not get their own portion of land. V'hayta lahem l'nachala, ani nachalatam b'achuzah, lo titnu lahem b'Yisrael, ani achuzatam. God, or in Rashi's words, the kuhuna, will be their nachala, their inheritance. It's as though they will reside together with God in this separate strip of land, maintaining the kedusha that is required of them. Besides the land for the Kohanim, the strip of land called Truma, it will also include areas for other Leviim, a city for Israelites, and plots of land for the Nasi. This Nasi, this leader, who will get a portion of this Truma land, who is he? We don't know for sure. But in Pasuk Tet, these leaders are told, Rav lachem nesi'ei Yisrael. It's enough, leaders of Israel. Chamas v'shod hasiru, u'mikshpat u'tzdaka asu. Remove your stealing and your bribery, and instead, live by justice and righteousness. Notice, by the way, this language, Rav lachem, in that pasuk, words also used in reference to the Kohanim in the last parak. We've heard that language before, back in Chumash. That language evokes the words Korach and his people said to Moshe and Aaron, accusing them of trying to raise themselves above their leaders. V'yikalu al Moshe v'al Aaron, v'yamru alehem, Rav lachem, ki kol ha'ida kulam kitoshim, v'tocham Hashem, u'madu atit nasu al kahal Hashem. Enough, Korach and his cohort say. The whole nation is holy, and God is within everyone. Why should you raise yourselves above the rest of the nation? Notice that word, titnasu, for raise yourself up. If Yechezkel's Rav Lachem plays off of Korach, maybe his reference to a nasi plays off Korach too, a leader in the sense of those who raise themselves up. There's more to say on that topic. But one thing is clear from these words of Korach. Leaders can easily be the subject of complaints. They, like Moshe and Aaron, can be seen as having selfish motives, even when they are trying to do their best. Which might explain why there is an entire section in Perek Mem Vav devoted to the laws of the Nasi that will lead the nation at the end of days. Like the Kohanim, when it comes to the Nasi, the leader, it's important to get it right, to set the stage for success. Now the next section in our parak, starting in Pasuk Yudchet, describes a series of korbanot, which are brought, according to the Malbim, as part of the inauguration of this new third Mikdash. Here is Pasuk Yudchai. Ko amar Hashem Elokim, barishon b'echad l'chodesh, tikach par ben bakar tamim, v'chiteta et ha-mikdash. God instructs that on the first of the month, you should bring a young, pure calf and offer it in the Mikdash. And then, in Pasuk Yotet, V'lakach ha-kohen midam ha-chatat. The kohen is to take the blood of this korban. V'natan el mezuzot ha-bayit ve'el arba pinot ha-azara la-mizbeach. And he is to place this blood on the mezuzot, the doorposts of the house, and on the corners of the mizbeach. And finally, al mezuzat shar ha-chatzer ha-pnimit. He is to place the blood on the doorposts of the inner courtyard of God's bayit. Now, just think about that. This procedure, putting the blood on doorposts of a home, where else have we heard that before? We don't get that very often in Tanakh. Of course, it reminds us of the night we left Mitzrayim. Back then, God told us to mark the mezuzot, the doorposts of our homes, with blood. And actually, this isn't the only connection between our parak to that night we left Mitzrayim. Take a moment to compare the relevant dates. In Shemot, we hear that the animal is supposed to be taken a few days before the blood is spread on the doorposts, and then the animal is to be watched over until Vayalachem leMishmeret ad 14 yom lachodesh, the 14th day of the month. And listen to how similar it is here in Yechezkel and Perek Mem Hei. There too, one is to take the animal a few days early, and then Vayalachem leMishmeret ad 14 yom lachodesh. The animal is to be watched over until the 14th of the month, the same month of Nisan, as it were. And, wait a minute, the 14th of Nisan. That's Pesach, isn't it? It absolutely is. And here, the parallels continue still further. Back in Shemot, the next thing we hear is the advent of Chag HaMatzot. Shiv'at Yamim Matzot Tochelu. And similarly in our parak in Yechezkel, Shavuot Yamim Matzot Yachel. So the connections abound between these texts. They are pretty hard to deny, but what are we supposed to make of them? Why would this story in Yechezkel, part of the inauguration ceremony of the Mikdash HaBayit Shlishi, mirror so closely the story of Bnei Yisrael leaving Mitzrayim? Well, the truth is, the answer might be bound up in one other set of parallels, because there's actually another text in Sefer Yechezkel which also shows strong parallels to the story of the Exodus of Yetziyah Mitzrayim. But fair warning, that other story in Yechezkel, it mirrors a darker, more ominous aspect of Yetziyah Mitzrayim. The story of Yetziyah Mitzrayim, of the Exodus, it actually came with its fair share of sorrow. In Mitzrayim, Ve'avarti, God passed over. Ve'hikeiti, God struck. There was a tzaka, there were screams in Mitzrayim. L'mashchi, there was a destroyer. And that destruction, it affected the entire society. In the words of the Pasuk in Shemot, Kol b'chor b'eretz Mitzrayim, b'chor paro ha-yoshev al kis'o, ad b'chor ha-shevi asher b'beit habor, v'chol b'chor b'hema. In fact, ein bayit asher ein shem mit. There was not one house that didn't get affected. And in Mitzrayim, something would save people, the mark of blood on the doorpost that God would see. This ultimately would be the mark that would save them. Okay, so let's take all this and come back to Sefer Yechezkel. This idea of marks that will identify people in order to save them. We actually remember that from many prakim earlier in the Sefer. Remember back around Perek Tet and Yud, Yechezkel saw a vision of a man who was to place a mark on the foreheads of people in Yerushalayim who were Ne'anachim and Ne'anakim. Those marks would identify and save those that were to be saved during the coming destruction of Yerushalayim. Yes, the destruction of our own city, described in Perek Tet. This, too, seems to echo the very same night that we left Mitzrayim. There, too, back in Yechezkel, Perek Tet, there were a group of angelic figures that were told to la'avor, to pass over the people. And there was an angelic mashchit, who led a group of men with instruments, klei mashchit, instruments of destruction. These destroyers were to strike the city, v'hiku, same word as the word used in Makkah Bechorel, in Mitzrayim, the 10th plague. And in Yechezkel, in Perek Tet, there too, just like in the Exodus, there was a cry. Yechezkel cried out about the destruction. He cried out to God about the mashchit, the destruction that would come upon Yerushalayim. Yechezkel cried out, saying, HaMashchit ata et kol shevi Yisrael? God, would you really destroy the whole of Israel? Here, too, there was a fear, just as there was a fear in Mitzrayim, a fear that the entire gamut of society would be struck. Zaken bachor uvetula v'taf v'nashim. And now, consider the role of blood in Yitziyat Mitzrayim and in Perek Tet in Yechezkel. When it came to the destruction in Mitzrayim, God would see the blood on the door and save the inhabitants inside. In Yerushalayim, God says he will see blood too. But this time, the blood won't be the blood that would save them. It would be the bloodshed that was performed in the city. The bloodshed that gave the city its sorry nickname, the Ir Hadamim, the city of bloodshed. So again, what do we make of all this? Well, thinking about the larger picture here, here is one way to think about the connections between the night the firstborn were destroyed in Mitzrayim and the vision of Yechezkel of Yerushalayim being destroyed. Who exactly did the mashchit target in Mitzrayim? It was those who enforced slavery, who made people serve human masters who were corrupt, that the people had no business serving. Well, here in Yerushalayim, who does the mashchit target? Sadly, a version of the same thing. The mashchit destroys idolaters, those who needlessly and corruptly compel themselves to serve masters that they have no business serving. In Mitzrayim, it was the Egyptians who were targeted. Later, in the Chorban, the target would be the idolatrous inhabitants of Yerushalayim itself. But as we saw, that's not the entire story. Because as we saw before, the night of Yitziyat Mitzrayim seems to foreshadow two narratives in Yechezkel. One was in Perek Tet, toward the beginning of the Sefer. That was a story of tragedy. But the other episode, with parallels to the same night in Mitzrayim, the vision Yechezkel has toward the end of the Sefer, in Perek Mem, that vision describes a moment of ultimate triumphant redemption. Both are reminiscent of Pesach, each in their own way. Maybe, once again, we are looking at bookend narratives. In the beginning of the book, destruction will come upon the house of God, the Mikdash, mirroring the destruction that once came upon those who didn't bear the mark that saved them back in the book of Exodus. That mark of blood would have distinguished the house that bore it as a house devoted to God. But here, ironically and tragically, the nation's own house, its communal Beit HaMikdash, the house supposedly devoted to God, this house ends up being destroyed because it is not really a house devoted to God anymore. Instead, there is blood, but it is not on the door. The city itself is called a city of blood. And the Mikdash? It is indistinguishable from the corrupt houses of the kings around it. But at the end of Yechezkel, described in our Perek, blood will be placed on the door of the third Mikdash to consecrate it to God. In so doing, the sins that led to the destruction of the first Mikdash, sins that were characterized with the symbols of mezuzot, betitam sipam el sipi mezuzatam el mezuzati, these sins will be rectified. The house really will stand apart as a house devoted to God. The blood on the door will symbolize that. And therefore, in celebration afterwards, Pesach is celebrated in the Mikdash. It has a new meaning now. It contains not just memories of Pesach Mitzrayim, of the time that God passed over our houses in Egypt and spared us, This time in the third Mikdash, God is passing over a contemporary house, the Beit HaMikdash itself, and ensuring that it will be spared from future destruction because the people's devotion to God will be firm. Thank you for studying together the Le'ilui Nishmat Riva Schwab, Rivka Bat Alexander Center.